B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Monday, January 6, 2020. As America lurches into a new war with Iran in the Middle East. There's too much news to comment on today. I reviewed over 45 different reports that I've boiled down in today's News and Comment podcast, and I have no idea how long this is going to run. Our lead story today is a surprise. John Bolton, the mustachioed former national security advisor to Donald Trump, the Iran hawk who left the administration without fulfilling his wet dream of a confrontation with Tehran, John Bolton decided today, he made an announcement that he is now ready to testify at the Trump impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate, which is not yet scheduled and, of course, hasn't been triggered because Speaker Pelosi continues to hold on to the articles of impeachment, trying to leverage that for a better process in the Senate trial. Now, we've got to be skeptical of John Bolton. He is a wily partisan. And he has tweeted his overwhelming support for Trump's attack on Iran by killing General Soleimani in Baghdad last week. At the same time, based on the testimony of Fiona Hill and others, we know that Bolton was hopping mad at the Ukrainian scheme, at Rudy Giuliani's freelancing. He called it a drug deal that he didn't want any part of. And that's on the record now. And can Bolton, by volunteering to testify if he receives a subpoena, he's saying he's waiving the court process. Will he tell the truth? Or will he try to present some alternate facts? That's anybody's guess at this point. But I think it throws Mitch McConnell off base, because the Senate Majority Leader has been at least publicly avoiding any commitment to allowing witnesses to testify in the Senate trial who didn't testify in the impeachment inquiry in the House. And it only takes three Republicans to defect and say, well, look, if John Bolton is willing to testify, then we want to hear from him. That could be Romney, Murkowski from Alaska, Collins from Maine. And maybe there are other Republicans. That, of course, presumes that all the Democrats stay in line, and we can't count on that. But this is a remarkable development. According to Bolton, a statement on his website, I have concluded that if the Senate issues a subpoena for my testimony, I am prepared to testify. It now falls to the Senate to fulfill its constitutional obligation to try impeachments, and it does not appear possible that a final judicial resolution of the still unanswered constitutional questions can be obtained before the Senate acts. Accordingly, since my testimony is once again at issue, I have had to resolve the serious competing issues as best I could, based on careful consideration and study. Now, that's a whole lot of bullshit. But this could lead to other former administration officials like Don McGahn, who is central to the Mueller report's credible contentions of obstruction of justice by Trump in his repeated attempts to get McGahn to fire St. Bob Mueller in the middle of his investigation. So it is a whole new wrinkle. And anybody who tells you they know what's going to happen next is a liar. Now, before we go deep into the Iran contretemps, I want to report on three or four other items that I think could get lost in the corporate media's wall-to-wall coverage of the potential for war that they're all just chomping at the bit for. They know it's good for ratings and controversy, and they don't give a shit about the people who will die or the long-term implications. So, over the weekend, there was an attempt by Juan Guaido, who claims to be the designated leader of Venezuela. He was trying to get himself reelected as the president or chair of the National Assembly. That is the perch that he had last year when he falsely claimed that he was the rightful leader of Venezuela, and the U.S. and some 50 nations fell in line behind that lie. And predictably, the corporate media coverage of the events in Caracas are yellow journalism at its worst. First, the New York Times dispatch. Venezuela's authoritarian leader Nicolas Maduro moved Sunday to consolidate his grip on power by taking control of the country's last independent institution and sidelining the man who had staked a rival claim to the presidency. You note they don't call that rival claim false or unproven. No, they take it at face value. Later, they report Venezuela now has two men who assert they are the rightful president and two rival legislatures, one of which has two competing leaders, since Maduro's supporters Sunday elected one man to lead it and Guaido's supporters gathered at a newspaper's headquarters to reelect him. Now, this fiction that there is some parity, that there's some equivalency between Maduro and his government, which is tagged a regime because we don't like him, and these claims of a power grab by Juan Guaido, which are rationalized because, well, he has the support of the oligarchs. He is a corporate guy who would sell the oil. and so it is almost laughable. And there's even worse yellow journalism from Britain's Guardian, which is on board for a regime change in Venezuela. Here's their lead. Venezuela's opposition has accused President Nicolas Maduro of masterminding an illegal parliamentary coup after an apparent bid to decapitate the challenge from his presidential rival, Juan Guaido, by replacing him as head of the country's opposition-controlled parliament. Now, he didn't lock Guaido up. That's what a thug would do. And if he was this, strong man, total dictator, wouldn't he have had Guaido deported, killed, locked up, and tortured? He's been allowed to be free. And what Maduro did was use political tools to eliminate a pesky opposition leader a full year after he surfaced to challenge Maduro's legitimacy. And this is almost cartoonish. Again, citing The Guardian, there were scenes of chaos and confusion as security forces and riot troops blocked opposition lawmakers and journalists from entering the parliament building. Dramatic video footage showed Guaido attempting to climb over a fence into the assembly's grounds, but being repelled by members of Maduro's Bolivarian National Guard. And unbowed, Guaido said, "Today, once again, we have defeated the dictatorship. We have resoundingly defeated the dictatorship's intentions." Really? Meanwhile, in an ugly move that, again, I feel will be buried by all of the lapdog coverage of an impending war with Iran, we learn that the Trump administration has started deporting Mexican nationals, including families, who came to the U.S. border seeking asylum in order to escape the threat of violence from drug cartels and others in Mexico. And so instead of letting them into the United States and either detaining them or allowing them to live freely until their asylum cases can be heard, Trump is trying to send a message to others who would seek asylum that the drawbridge at Fortress America is up and it ain't coming down anytime soon. So starting in December, 43 asylum seekers from El Salvador and Honduras were deported to Guatemala, and in short order, a group of Mexicans were sent to Guatemala. Now, it's really hard to compare threats and levels of violence, but it's very clear that Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras are relatively failed states compared to Mexico. And so for a Mexican who fears for their life and comes to the U.S. and begs for protection, we're sending them to one of the most dangerous countries in this hemisphere. And that's not only cruel, it violates American law on asylum, and it subjects people to greater risks. And Trump feels that by making an example and treating people as a class and then punishing the class, that that's going to be the deterrent, that the cages for kids apparently did not deliver. In other news, Julian Castro, the former housing secretary who bowed out of the presidential race last week, has announced that he is endorsing Elizabeth Warren. Not sure it will move many votes. I like Julian Castro, and I like the some of the points that he made in his campaign, particularly about the need to reform our police operations. But he's been polling under 5%, and Elizabeth Warren has kind of flatlined recently. Latest poll out today from CBS found that in Iowa, Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, and Pete Buttigieg are tied for first place with 23% each. Warren is back about 7 points at 16%, and Amy Klobuchar is fifth at 7%. In New Hampshire, it is Sanders in the lead with 27, Biden 25, 18 for Warren, 13 for Buttigieg, and 7% once again for Klobuchar. Over the weekend in Kenya, three Americans, including a uniformed soldier and two contractors from the Pentagon, were killed by, we're told, members of Al-Shabaab. This occurred before dawn on Sunday. It was at the Manda Bay airfield. And there are various claims about other casualties. But I want you to think about this, because Trump's reaction with a bombing raid and then the assassination of Soleimani and then another bombing raid that we'll get to in a minute was, we are told, in reaction to the death in Kirkuk of a single American contractor. And we have absolutely no details on that. We don't know who the person was, what the conditions were, the context of their reported demise. But it's been blamed on Iran and on Iranian-backed militias in Iraq. Now, the claim is also made that Al-Shabaab is an extension of Al-Qaeda. They killed not just two contractors, but a uniformed American soldier. So, if Trump's reaction in Iraq is any model, he should be sending drones to kill the top general of Al-Shabaab, impose sanctions, and threaten to bomb them into the Stone Age. Let's see how he plays that one. Now, one of the most astounding reports comes from Max Blumenthal, a young journalist who I have great respect for, and at the Gray Zone, he provides coverage that I haven't seen anywhere else, and I'm going to cite a New York Times report with a glaring omission. But first, a Blumenthal scoop. He got a copy of the transcript or a translation of a speech that was given in the Iraqi parliament by its prime minister, Adil Abdul Mahdi. Now, the headline that the mainstream media took away from his speech is that he is calling for removal of all U.S. troops from Iraq. And that is a newsworthy item. But get this. According to Abdul Mahdi, he had been planning to meet General Soleimani on the morning that the general was killed by the American drone strike to discuss a diplomatic rapprochement that Iraq was brokering between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And the prime minister said that Trump personally thanked him for the efforts, even as he was planning the hit on Soleimani, creating the impression that the Iranian general was safe to travel to Baghdad because Trump was asking the Iraqis to support this kind of brokering of or mediation. I wouldn't quite call them peace talks, but Max Blumenthal describes it as a peace mission. And he writes, Soleimani had arrived in Baghdad not to plan attacks on American targets, but to coordinate de-escalation with Saudi Arabia. Indeed, he was killed while on an actual peace mission that could have created political distance between the Gulf monarchy and members of the U.S.-led anti-Iran axis like Israel. Now, I invite you to look far and wide. I can't read everything, I can't watch everything on television. But this is a really critical element of the story. And the treachery that Trump led here seems to be like he's in a competition with Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, who everybody knows orchestrated the killing and bone chopping of Adnan Khashoggi. And this gets glossed over in the mainstream media. And it's up to a scrappy reporter like Max Blumenthal at an indie media site, the Gray Zone Project, to bring it forward. Now let's compare that to Peter Baker, one of the bright veteran reporters and analysts at the New York Times. He chooses to focus on Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut. He publishes a tweet from Murphy, thusly, "The moment we all feared is likely upon us. An unstable president in way over his head, panicking, with all his experienced advisors having quit, and the only the sycophantic amateurs remaining. Assassinating foreign leaders, announcing plans to bomb civilians. A nightmare." And Baker goes on to talk about Mike Pompeo's multiple appearances on the Sunday morning political shows. And I saw one of them for a few minutes. I usually avoid them. But Pompeo would not provide any evidence of the transgressions of the Iranians that led to this provocative assassination. And they don't mention, even though here's the part about the Iraqi parliament vote to force American troops to leave, but nothing about what Soleimani was in Baghdad for. And this omission is the way the corporate media shapes the narrative consistent with the interests of the administration and the military-industrial complex. And this is what forms the basis for fascism. So Peter Baker decided to quote a guy, a former CIA specialist, who is now at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, which is an integral part of the Israel lobby in Washington. Quoting Ruel Mark Gerecht, "Trump actually has a very strong hand vis-a-vis the clerical regime. Whether he chooses to play it, I don't know. He's not a strategist. But his tactical game hasn't been bad. The hit on Soleimani was genius. Totally flummoxed his opponent." Now, tomorrow, I have several pieces that didn't fit in today's podcast that I will try to bring you about the propaganda of this moment and how to try to insulate yourself from it a little bit. And here's a final line from Peter Baker. "Trump has said he took out Soleimani, whose forces have been responsible for the deaths of hundreds of American troops over the years, not to start a war, but to stop it." Well, they fail to mention that General Soleimani was operating in reaction to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, a war we started. And now, retroactively, we say, well, he was this brutal guy who killed our soldiers. But we sent our soldiers in there to topple a government and occupy a nation that is a neighbor of Iran. And if somebody did that in Mexico or Canada, what would we do? In a news report over the weekend, the Times also reported that people at the Pentagon were aghast because they had given Trump a list of options of what he could do to react to the reported killing of this single American contractor in Iraq. Again, we have no details on that incident. But they gave him a list, and this idea of killing General Soleimani was the most extreme. By late Thursday, the president had gone for the extreme option. Top Pentagon officials were stunned. What kind of bullshit is that? If they put it on the list, they had to expect that he might choose it. And this is simply a way of, you know, trying to continue the attacks on Trump. I don't support Trump, but I also don't support underhanded ways of trying to smear him. And it boggles my mind as I try to explain that. Sorry if you're confused, but it's difficult to parse the different elements of Trump, the way he is reported on, and the extent to which that is biased or misleading. And that's what I try to do here. Now, our dear tweeter took to his phone over the weekend, and he leveled a serious threat at the leadership in Iran. He said that his people have identified 52 locations, targets, in Iran, one for each American hostage who was held at the embassy back in 1979. Now, this not only is a ridiculous way of dredging up old enmity and grudges, but Trump included the gratuitous comment that his 52 targets included some cultural sites. Now, that is a flat-out war crime. But he doesn't care, because here's his justification. They're allowed to torture and maim our people. They're allowed to use roadside bombs and blow up our people. And we're not allowed to touch their cultural site? It doesn't work that way. Well, we're the people who have publicly been exposed for torturing and maiming the suspects during the so-called global war on terror. And the equivalent of roadside bombs is the way we use drones to target individuals without any process, and snuff their lives out. So, this is just another impulsive move by Trump, who knows no limits, has no sensibility like that. And this will only enrage people. Even Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister, has said that Britain would not participate in the bombing of cultural sites. And the daughter of journalist Terry Anderson, who was held for 6 years by the Iranian-backed Hezbollah, she went to Twitter with this. Here's a thought. Maybe ask ex-hostages if they want to each be assigned to represent a military target that could kill many civilians, supposedly in their honor. That's from Suleyman Anderson. I'm struck by a report at BuzzFeed today, which nominally looks good. They talk about how Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, who was Hillary Clinton's running mate in 2016, has introduced a war powers resolution to end hostilities with Iran only until military actions are approved by Congress. This appears to be a protest over process, not a statement of opposition to a meaningless, gratuitous war. And let's be fair. The people who have been front and center fighting to end the blank check that was given to George W. Bush in the fall of 2001 and to put constraints on war powers of this president are Barbara Lee of Oakland, Ro Khanna from Silicon Valley, they're members of the House, and Bernie Sanders, not Tim Kaine. Many of us recall the blunder of George W. Bush shortly after 9/11 when he referred to the U.S. response as a crusade, and he quickly cleaned up that language. But Trump, on Friday, just hours after the big kill of General Soleimani, went to Miami, where he spoke to a group of evangelical Hispanics at the Internacional El Rey Jesus Church. And he told them that we have God on our side. Now, that's a bad line from an old Bob Dylan song. I recommend a Wire Train version if you want to look it up on Spotify. But this is so dangerous. And consider Mike Pompeo, plain Secretary of State, was on the Sunday morning shows, and his talking point line was to repeatedly call the government in Iran a kleptocratic, theocratic regime. Now, that is a case of projection, because Trump is identified as a Christian nationalist. That's theocratic. And he is quite a kleptocrat. There's a lengthy record of that. And using the magic word regime allows many people to rationalize any kind of confrontation, including military, with Iran. This, too, is quite dangerous. A few minutes ago, I mentioned that there was a second airstrike in Iraq against so-called Iran-backed militias just a few hours after the drone strike that took out Qasem Soleimani. Now, I saw this reported by Richard Engel on MSNBC during Rachel Maddow's show. I think it was on Thursday night. And I have not seen it anywhere else. Now, it is confirmed by a report in Britain's independent newspaper. We are told that a convoy of Iran-backed militia was hit. As many as five people were killed. And this was in an unidentified northern area of Iraq. I don't understand why that has been omitted from the corporate media narrative, except for that single report that I'm aware of from NBC. Today, the government of Iran began announcing its reactions. And you could call this retaliatory. But because the U.S. was the first to breach the six-nation nuclear agreement with Iran, their decision to expand and increase uranium enrichment is a pretty rational reaction. They had given that up in exchange for an end of sanctions. Trump pulled out of the deal, reimposed sanctions. And I don't believe that Iran really wants a nuclear weapon. Gareth Porter established that in his book a couple of years ago. And in fact, in the announcement of increased enrichment, there was no mention of backing off from promises that it's not seeking a nuclear weapon. Another form of potential retaliation is cyber warfare. This report from USA Today: a federal website was offline Sunday after a hacker uploaded photos that included an Iranian flag and an image depicting a bloodied President Trump being punched in the face. I've never been to the website of the Federal Depository Library Program, and I'll bet you haven't either. But some hackers found it, and they posted a page exclaiming Iranian hackers, an image of the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and a message that martyrdom was Soleimani's reward for years of implacable efforts. And this statement was posted: with his departure and with God's power, his work and path will not cease, and severe revenge awaits those criminals who have tainted their filthy hands with his blood and the blood of other martyrs. Now, this quite possibly could have been conducted by Iran, by the Quds Force, cyber team, or somebody else there. But we do have to be skeptical. This could be a false flag, could have been placed there by Baron Trump, by Chinese cyber warriors, by North Korea, or even possibly Russia. But most people will take it on first impression and just assume, oh, this is Iranian retribution for what we did to General Soleimani. And this one's pretty predictable. At the Canada-U.S. border in Blaine, Washington, over the weekend, some number of Iranian Americans had traveled into Canada to attend a music concert. And as they returned, again, these are mostly Iranian Americans. Apparently a handful of non-citizens were detained as well. But some people were held for as long as 10 hours. And given the whole immigration crackdown that Trump has presided over, the Muslim ban, his hysteria, and fear of foreigners, we can expect to see more of that. And to some extent, one would say it's rational. If we have attacked a country, they might try to attack us back and send agents, provocateurs, into our country. But to consider every Iranian American as a suspect, that is a dangerous escalation. I picked up an interesting document here, dated 2019, from the Defense Intelligence Agency. It is a summary of Iran's military posture. And it defines Iran as primarily being on a defensive footing. While attempting to strengthen its deterrence against foreign attack and influence, Tehran has committed itself to becoming the dominant power in the turbulent and strategic Middle East. Its ambitions and identity as a largely Persian Shia power in a region composed of primarily Arab Sunni states often put it at odds with its neighbors. And so, here is our official intelligence agency summary. And, of course, none of that matters. Because, well, we'll get into that in a couple of minutes here when we look at some of the commentary that has surfaced just in the last few days. I want to note that many Americans who oppose Trump's dangerous actions took to the streets over the weekend. There were thousands of people marching in San Francisco, hundreds described in Los Angeles. Minneapolis had a big crowd, Chicago, in Times Square in New York. People took to the streets. And I am very pleased to see that not everyone is taking this in a passive way. Every day I pause for a minute to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. And I want to thank our good friend Del Leonard, who checked in, as he does every January, with a nice check contributing to our operations here. Also want to mention Clifford Johnson, Carl Howard, and Jim Garrison, who each kick in $5 to $20 a month. You can do it too. Visit peterbcollins.com, click on menu, click on become a subscriber, and when you hit the sign up page, you can choose an option that's comfortable for you and your budget. If you're allergic to PayPal, just address your correspondence to my P.O. Box, number 15660, San Rafael, California, 94901. So you may want to pause this and come back later, but I have a pile here of very valuable commentary that has come from people I respect over the past few days, and I want to recommend it to you. I've placed links in the show file for the podcast to most of these commentaries that I'm going to cite. The first is from Colonel Andrew Basevich, a military man with a strong sense of the imperialist danger of American foreign policy in recent years. He writes in the LA Times, "Since 9/11, U.S. military exertions in the region have destroyed what little order once existed. Today, there is anarchy, civil wars, failed states, terrorist organizations that did not even exist when the American global war on terrorism commenced nearly two decades ago. Iraq itself, today host to pro-Iranian militias and targeted by U.S. airstrikes, embodies that failure nearly 17 years after its supposed liberation. More importantly, the U.S. Middle East wars will continue due to the intellectual bankruptcy of the foreign policy establishment." And he singles out the Democrats. He said, "This will happen in no small part because the Congress is pusillanimous and supine, having long once since forfeited its constitutionally prescribed authority regarding war. The Democratic members of the Senate and House who whine about not having been consulted or notified in advance of the drone attack deserve not a respectful hearing, but contempt. Their behavior over the past decade and more in giving presidents a free hand to wage war, however they see fit, cannot be described as anything but cowardly. After all, it was President Obama who pioneered the role of assassination in chief, to which Trump has now laid claim. One more bite. Within that establishment, forgetting takes precedence over learning. Note, for example, how quickly Washington has moved on after last month's publication of the Afghanistan papers, with their astonishing revelations of pervasive waste, incompetence, and blatant dishonesty in the conduct of America's longest war." Then, to another piece at Counterpunch, byline Paul Street. He states the same, but a little stronger. "Democrats and their media allies have little moral ground to stand on when it comes to criticizing Trump's action. From the beginning of Trump's anti-Iran and Tehran-provoking and punishing presidency, Democrats and the liberal media have fully participated in advancing the ludicrous imperial notion that Iran is a uniquely evil, dangerous, belligerent, destabilizing, and terrorist actor in the Middle East, the region's top malign aggressor." And he notes that the most truly aggressive, destructive, and malevolent state actor is the state of Israel. followed closely by Saudi Arabia. So there's more to his piece, but I encourage you to read it. Also, Scott Ritter, the former U.S. Marine intelligence officer and U.N. weapons inspector, has already published two pieces, and one of my Facebook friends reacted pretty strongly when I posted the first one because Scott Ritter chose to publish it at the state-owned media outlet RT. That's run by the Russians. And I find that his voice is consistent here. He has not been tainted or poisoned by being published at RT. But I know that knocks Russiagate people right on their asses. Anyway, he is a very smart man who does not mince words. Soleimani is the direct result of America's irresponsibly aggressive policies. In a world defined by cause-effect relationships, the link between Soleimani and the United States is undeniable. He goes back to 1998 when, continuing through to 9/11, Soleimani was in league with the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan, and after 9/11, he coordinated with the United States, which took over the payroll of the Northern Alliance and used them as the advance wedge of the U.S. occupation, which, as you know, continues to this day. Ritter writes, Soleimani didn't emerge in a vacuum, was the manifestation of the logical response of Iran to external threats brought on by the actions of others. Iran's intervention in Syria came on the heels of a massive intervention by outside powers, including the U.S., Turkey, and Saudi Arabia, to create a resistance designed to remove Bashar al-Assad from power. And so Ritter accurately recaps the history. Soleimani's actions were not part of a master Iranian plan for regional domination, but part and parcel of Iran's ability to react effectively to the mistakes made by the United States and its allies in implementing policies of aggression in the region. And Ritter concludes in his first article, murdered, Soleimani is transferred into a martyr hero whose exploits will motivate those who seek to replicate them against an American foe, void of the kind of self-constraint and wisdom born of experience. And when you see the millions of people who took to the streets to honor General Soleimani all over Iran, we have succeeded in uniting Iranians who were just a couple of months ago protesting. So the unintended consequences, which you and I can see pretty clearly here, didn't appear to occur to Trump and whoever it was he consulted. We don't think it was too many people before he pulled the trigger here. Now, in his second article, Scott Ritter writes that the successor to General Soleimani is General Hossein Dehghan, D-E-H-G-H-A-N. He said, our reaction will be wise, well-considered, and in time, with decisive deterrent effect. It was America that has started the war. Therefore, they should accept appropriate reactions to their actions. The only thing that can end this period of war is for the Americans to receive a blow that is equal to the blow they have inflicted. And Ritter then speculates on what they'll target. Well, he does believe that there are realistic constraints on what Iran can do. But he suspects that they may attack U.S. forces in Kuwait, the Fifth Fleet in Bahrain, and or at the Al Udeid airbase in Qatar. He said, of these three, that airbase has a direct connection to the Soleimani assassination. The drones that fired the missiles that killed him were operated from there. Later, he says, if Iran were to strike a U.S. facility like Al Udeid and Trump were to order a response, then Iran would most likely unleash the totality of its military capability and those of its regional proxies to devastate the military and economic capabilities of those targeted. Strong words and credible information from Scott Ritter. Meanwhile, at Consortium News, I recommend Pepe Escobar's piece in concert with the item I read to you or quoted from in Counterpunch. Pepe Escobar starts off by fingering Israel. He says Trump may have issued the order, the deep state may have ordered him to issue the order, or the usual suspects may have ordered them all. According to my best Southwest Asia intel sources, quote, Israel gave the U.S. the coordinates for the assassination of Qasem Soleimani as they wanted to avoid the repercussions of taking the assassination upon themselves. There's more in his piece, but I think that's the big takeaway. A little later, he says the American strike also targets the Ayatollah in Iraq, Sistani, and that because we killed a major Iraqi general, that there could be local blowback in Iraq that is not influenced by Iran. Also at Consortium News, a great new memo from the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. They, too, take a look at Israel. It's time to call a spade, they write. The country expecting to benefit most from hostilities between Iran and the U.S. is Israel, with Saudi Arabia in second place. As you know, no doubt are aware, they write to the president, Prime Minister Netanyahu is fighting for his political life. He continues to await from you the kind of gift that keeps giving. Likewise, it appears that you, your son-in-law, and other myopic pro-Israel advisors are as susceptible to the influence of the prime minister as George W. Bush was. I also want to recommend a piece by Craig Murray, the former British ambassador who is a strong supporter of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, and he exposes the Bethlehem Doctrine of preemptive self-defense. We've heard Trump and Pompeo saying that we had to act because of an imminent threat of an attack by Iranian-backed forces. And Murray exposes how Daniel Bethlehem, this isn't related to the manger town, was an advisor first to Netanyahu and then to Tony Blair in Britain. And he provided the memos like, J. Bybee, and good old professor at UC Berkeley, John Yoo. They wrote the memos that rationalized torture and expansive presidential powers during the Bush administration. And this is a well-written piece that gives you details on how empty and how incredible and unsupportable this whole idea of defensive preemptive strike. And it's largely based on redefining the word imminent to make it virtually meaningless. And finally today, I want to cite a commentary that's attributed to Chaz W. Freeman. He's a man I deeply respect, a Middle East expert who was too hot for Obama. Obama appointed him and then withdrew the appointment after complaints from the allies of Israel. Let me quote here, Chaz Freeman. This was not a retaliation as claimed, but the pre-planned exploitation of a pretext to assassinate a foreign official designated as an enemy, as well as the commander of an Iraqi militia hostile to the United States. It was an act of war that will inevitably evoke reprisal. Iran has already promised that it will exact savage retribution for the murder of its senior official. And now, because General Soleimani was the equivalent of national security advisors or the commanders of CENTCOM, SOCOM, or other acronyms, all are now potential Iranian targets. In Iraq itself, the followers of Abu Mahdi, that's the general who was killed, will seek their own revenge. The fact that they're part of the Iraqi national security establishment and armed forces is not irrelevant. The Iraqi government, already under pressure to expel U.S. forces, may now find it politically impossible not to do so. Later, he writes, it is hard to avoid the conclusion that the timing of the attack was dictated by the turmoil in American domestic politics. It was preceded by three airstrikes on elements of Kataib Hezbollah for the death of a civilian contractor in Kirkuk. But none of these airstrikes was anywhere near Kirkuk. They bore the marks of a pre-planned operation looking for a pretext to launch. And one more quote from Chaz Freeman. The assassination seemed intended to appease neoconservative critics of Trump as vacillating and weak in his response to Iranian riposte to his policy of maximum pressure. They provide a welcome distraction from the pending impeachment proceedings and appeal to the bloodthirsty instincts of the president's most ardent supporters. They prepare the way for Mike Pompeo to offset his lack of diplomatic accomplishments with a demonstration of his ruthlessness to the new conservative voters of Kansas, where he intends to run for the Senate. In the new constitutional order in the United States, in which the separation of powers has been replaced by the separation of parties, the attack was politically expedient despite its blatant violation of the clear language of the U.S. Constitution. The attack thus represents an extrajudicial execution that marks a further departure from constitutional government and the rule of law in the United States. That's Chaz W. Freeman, and I'm Peter B. Collins. Thanks for listening to this daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube. I'm grateful.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.